All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian and anarcho-capitalist perspective. Tonight is episode 216 of the show, and we're talking about Stranger Than Fiction. That's right. We're sticking with the theater of the absurd. We did the Charlie Kaufman movie last week, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and we're doing another one that kind of breaks a couple of barriers and plays with narrative, and I think it also does a pretty good job. So that's going to be the one we're doing tonight. We will introduce our guests in just a moment when we get to the last narrative person's show. But I want to check in with my co-host, Taxman Robert Paul Johnson, who, due to my immaculate sports betting, we are now squaresies.
You taxed my winnings? You son of a bitch. What's up, D-Rock? Yeah, my dumb chickens choked. And they could not beat Goff as much as they tried. They're usually pretty good at beating Goff. But Goff came out of whatever injury, and he's probably playing hurt. But it was enough to choke my chickens. So I don't know how many more masturbation allure things I can do, but we'll see if I can. I'll try.
Yeah, Goff had a bad thumb too, and on his golfing hand. So
still managed to make the chickens. Yeah, even with a broken thumb, that takes some dedication. Usually you switch to the other hand, but he couldn't because he still had to throw that ball. I like it.
Right,
it's good.
All right, well, now that we've made this a PG-13 episode, why don't we move into the last night of sports of the show, and we'll clean things up a little bit for our guests. It's going to be Rachel Kennerly coming up right after this. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson. We are the Last Nighters. You can find us on lastnighters.com and also on the Liberty Movement YouTube channel. We'll have a link to that on the show notes page, which can be found at lastnighters.com/159, as this is the 159th episode of this here show. We're talking about Stranger Than Fiction with our friend Rachel Kennerly of Cannabis Heals Me and also of Just Add Liberty. Now, you'd think that a movie where people using barbaric means to threaten violence to take away someone else's stuff would be something like The Croods, which is a movie we were considering doing, but we live in a far more civilized time where they do it with the Fourth Amendment violations and forms in which you have to incriminate yourself. And if you get it wrong, you have to pay more or even go to jail. It's Stranger Than Fiction, and it also happens to be the movie we're discussing with a tax person, Rachel Kennerly. You are a CPA, is that correct?
That is correct, Daniel. I'm a licensed certified public accountant here in the state of Texas.
All right. Well, I think that makes you more than qualified for the tax man arguments in this, which I think are a lot of fun. And I'm sure that will be a big component of our discussion. I know Robert highlighted that in the pre-show content available for our Patreon supporters at lastnighters.com/Patreon. But I did mention that you are now running two shows, Cannabis Heals Me, and now the new one is Just Add Liberty. Would you mind letting our audience know what each of those shows about and where they can find them?
Sure. On Cannabis Heals Me, we talk with medical cannabis patients about their medical cannabis story, just trying to get past the emotional response of people more conservative and bring their stories to light to say, hey, there are medicinal properties to this plant. So we do that instead of throwing facts and figures at them. We do that through the power of storytelling. And then on Just Add Liberty, what we're trying to do over there is research ways that we can find more freedom in our own lives, whether it's through self-employment or homeschooling or, you know, a variety of different ways, being more, preparedness at, you know, having stuff in your pantry in case the world comes to an end and grocery stores shut down for a week or two, or growing a garden in the backyard. So just trying to pursue some of those topics where, because I think a lot of people, especially in the past 9-10 months, have felt pretty helpless about where, what they can do in their own lives to, you know, we're literally gagged and muzzled when we go out in public. And so, you know, just trying to give people ideas, ways to claw back a little bit of the liberty and freedom that have been taken from them.
Right. Yeah, that sounds really good. And I have listened to a couple of the episodes so far, so I highly recommend them. And when you launched that, it sparked something in me. I was like, oh, I could do something like that too. But mm-hmm. I haven't gotten off my ass to do it. So unfortunately, not happening just yet. But I do applaud that. And we will have links to those on our show notes page, of course. And you've also been on our show many times in the past. We did The Village last year. Around this time, we did something in between then and a few other. I can't even tell you what movies we've done with you. Do you recall?
I know we did Harold and Kumar. That was like our first one that we did.
Oh, right.
We did The Village.
Zombieland.
And Zombieland, yeah. So I think that's it. I think that's just those three. Or maybe there's more. I don't know.
I'll have to go back to the archives because this old noggin is getting a year older tomorrow and it's starting to fail on me, I think.
Yeah. So, well, happy birthday a day early.
Yeah, thank you. My kids are super excited about it. They wrapped up everything and decorated it with stickers and made me a journal that I can keep those stickers in after I'm done opening the presents.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's for the kids, the fact that we're, you know, making a big deal out of it, but it's kind of for me.
Yeah.
So
is it anyway, like a big birthday or just some ordinary run-of-the-mill birthday? Or is there like a milestone that you've achieved?
It's not a milestone, but it's I'm at that point where I wouldn't mind no longer counting or accruing. You know? There's no need to go any higher. We're good.
That's
we're good
right. Where we're at. Yeah, I've been there for a few years.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you. Welcome back to the show. And we're, of course, talking about Q Sound Effects, Stranger Than Fiction.
Budget boom.
Womp. All right, I got to figure out screen share here in just a moment. Because I like to share this stuff with you good people who are listening to this year's show. So let's see. Can you guys see this already?
Oh, we can see it.
But I also see a big, huge Stranger Than Fiction over the top of it.
Yeah, I got it sorted out here, I think. Let's see. Is that better? Better?
Nope.
Oh, I'm sorry. That Stranger Than
Fiction. Yeah, that's way better.
There we go. You see, this technology flummoxes me. I'm getting so much older and less, not so much wiser. But anyway, this is our episode tonight. So we're going to be doing Stranger Than Fiction. It is PG-13, came out in 2006, comedy/fantasy film, 1 hour and 53 minutes, of course, starring Will Ferrell, Maggie Gyllenhaal, is that how you say her name? Emma Thompson, Dustin Hoffman, among others, including Tony Hale, who is of course, hilarious in Arrested Development. But this came out again 2006, got 7.5 on the IMDb, 73% Rotten Tomatoes, and 67% on the old Metacritic. And 90% of Google users liked it. Here's the description: a mentally unstable IRS auditor, played by Will Ferrell, hears an author's voice in his head and discovers that he is the ill-fated protagonist of her latest work. While a book company employee, played by Queen Latifah, tries to cure the author's case of writer's block, the auditor and a professor, played by Dustin Hoffman, set out to find the woman and make her change her story. The director is Mark Forster, a screenplay by Zach Helm, and a box office of $53.7 million. And with that, I will go to Robert for your opening, please.
Alrighty. So this was a movie I saw back in the theater, 2006. And at the time, I think this was one of Will Ferrell's first going serious movies. I think, you know, Jim Carrey had started doing it. And so then maybe that gave Ferrell the idea, or maybe he thought he could always act. I don't know. But I think he does a perfectly good enough job to be the semi-serious straight man, but also have some comedic elements. But it's really the people that are acting opposite of him in this movie that have the best lines. Off the top of my head, I don't remember any just the moment, but I remember just laughing at him being the setup man and then them having the payoffs, which was nice.
He gets the due amount of respect in this movie as a IRS auditor. I think, you know, I've always argued that almost every single, not every single, but almost every single government agent should face this level of disrespect or outright hatred. I don't know why it's just, just the contempt. Yeah, it's just the IRS that gets it. But really, you're being stolen from by all of them. It's not just the IRS. The IRS is just the collection agency. It's all of them. So it's like getting mad at the messenger instead of, you know, the source. But hey, I'll take what I can get. So the most fun for me in this film is obviously his interactions with Maggie Gyllenhaal when he first goes into that bakery and the whole bakery just starts booing him and jeering him and everybody's just hating on him and he just takes it like it's just a normal thing.
Tax man.
Yeah. I mean, some of the best lines. I mean, I wrote down those scenes because those said the best lines. So I do want to get into those, but right now I'm just going to skim over them and say that those are the most entertaining for me because of obviously my political beliefs. But the movie itself is a really fun, creative idea. You know, what if you were writing a story about somebody that really existed and somehow that person was able to hear your descriptions of him as he goes about his day? What would happen? What would actually take place? And it's a pretty fun, creative little story. I like the crisis of conscience that she has at the end when she finds out she's actually killing people. I love the performances by Dustin Hoffman's really fun. He was just the whole way that he's entertaining this crazy person that walks into his office one day. And it's almost like you're enabling some psycho, but you know, he, for whatever reason, maybe just because of the story, he determines that Will Ferrell is not crazy. And I don't know if this happened in real life, how you would ever actually think that they're not crazy. So that, right, to me, that part of the story was a bit unbelievable because anybody comes around and says, hey, I'm hearing voices. They're talking about me. They're describing what I'm doing. There's no way you're thinking that this is anything that's actually really happening. But in the context of this universe that this story takes place in, it's a fun thing. So that whole, every scene that Dustin Hoffman's in, where they're trying to figure out what kind of story he's in, is really fun. So I had a great time with this film. I thought that the ending was a little bit schmaltzy, the way that, you know, she just kind of takes the coward way out and saves him and whatever. It's kind of a Hollywood ending, but I'll take it. The whole movie itself, I didn't really buy. The only thing I didn't really buy was Maggie Gyllenhaal falling for Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
I want to get Rachel's opinion on this. I want to get your opinion on this, Daniel, but I didn't see that romance at all. Like, I can get that he has a little bit of a awkward charm to him, and I could definitely get his romance feeling for her. She's all kinds of sexy and hot, but him being with the IRS and him, you know, basically threatening her with jail time, with all kinds of horrible things that could happen from all that, I didn't get that romance at all. So for me, that kind of part of the story falls a little bit, you know, so it's not like a perfect movie in that sense. But overall, I thought it was a fun, charming thing that I'll end up recommending and giving a positive score, but I'm not going to, this isn't like among the top 10 movies of the year kind of a thing for me. I thought it was fun. I thought it was well done, but it relies a little bit too much on its premise and not enough on its execution.
Interesting. Yeah. I also liked Hoffman in this one because he's at the same time dismissive and flippant about it, but yeah, then he's also kind of endearing at the same time. It's this weird mix of how he is, and you can't help but still like him.
Yes, his dismissal, but at the same time he's humoring him. It's just a fun little mechanic there.
Right, right. And then, yeah, I think I agree with you on the romance angle. Now, did you mean that Farrell and Gyllenhaal don't have good chemistry, or do you mean just in the story, in the characters, who they are, you just don't see that working?
I saw them having a little bit of chemistry. Like in any other movie, you put those two actors in it, and I'll probably buy some kind of a romance. But I don't think that the movie gave me enough to buy her feelings for him.
Right. Okay.
I mean, there was that one evening where he goes over to her house and she asks him in. Well, she asked him in, actually. She asked him to come in. And then he's like playing the guitar. I could see her falling for someone, maybe playing the guitar and playing that song, and that's a song she loves and whatever. But I didn't even buy her wanting him to come up.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And we can get into that in a little bit, but let's go to Rachel for your just your take overall on the opening and any of the comments that Robert's made so far.
Well, I think it's a little unfair for the analysis to call him a mentally unstable man. I mean, we come to find out he really was hearing voices. So I don't know that I agree that he was mentally unstable. Well, unless you work under the thought process that anybody that works for the IRS has to be mentally unstable in order to do that. But I didn't think, I mean, the description was kind of meh for me, but as the film goes, this is probably one of my top, I don't know, 20, 30 films. It's one that we rewatch. We were glad to see that it came on Netflix so that we could watch it. My husband and I both enjoy it. So it's a good overall film. I was surprised that it's PG-13 because I was thinking back and I'm like, is there really anything that would make it PG-13?
Oh, yeah. Maybe just when he gets hit by the bus. That's a little bit gruesome.
Maybe so.
Any language? I don't remember there being really any.
Yeah. I mean,
berate him for being a tax collector, auditor guy.
Maybe that's what it is. She was berating the state, and so that got it moved up to the PG-13 level.
Right. Yeah. There's this great Rothbard quote I shared
with Robert. You?
Where, you know, we can test this hypothesis of whether the state is there to protect the citizens or the state itself if we just look at how they punish crimes against either one. And I'm paraphrasing, mm-hmm. of course, but they always go after people who've desecrated the dignity of the state far more than anything else. And it's been highlighted time and time again in 2020, in contrast with recent events in Washington, D.C., where cities burned all summer and it went very nearly, you know, consequence free almost. And then something mm-hmm. that, yeah, sure, was probably done in poor judgment, but is being played up as the equivalent of a new 9/11. It's a pretty bizarre clown world, upside down world we live in.
Yeah, they'll crucify those people. They'll crucify anybody that evades taxes. But yeah, you can burn down the local grocery store and the Target and nobody's going to do anything about it.
Yeah. Very strange times we live in. I thought I was raised different.
Yeah.
But anyway, Robert, I know you've got some notes. You want to take us on a journey through them.
Well, the only thing I really took notes about was my favorite scenes. So it is. I mean, like you said, what's his name from Arrested Development plays like his friend. And there's a few scenes with him. And it's nice that even he had a little bit of an arc when, you know, when he thinks he's going to die and he sends his friend to space camp. And those are some nice little human elements. It should kind of shows some growth in the main character. But no, I want to talk about, and this is probably beating a dead horse for our kind of audience, but I want to revel in these scenes. I want to really, and I know this is like libertarianism 101 stuff, but so he comes into this, he gets this file, and his friend who plays in Arrested Development, you know his name, I forget his name.
Tony Hale.
He takes this big fat file and he gives him this little file because he's talking about hearing voices. So he's like, maybe you're a little bit stressed out. Maybe you should take this easy one. So he walks into this bakery and they immediately treat him as an IRS auditor, which is good. Yeah, I think they usually work in pairs in real life, so maybe it's not super accurate, but that's fine for me.
Armed, I would imagine.
Probably.
Well, that's there is a division that's armed and would work in pairs, but I mean, I think from the IRS perspective, is this really does this really reflect reality? No, they're not typically going to send a senior auditor down because somebody didn't pay their taxes. They're going to send them letters saying, hey, you didn't pay your tax bill. And then they're going to levy their bank account and take the money.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think
not actually physically send somebody down there.
I think they needed it as a plot device as well to have him have access to the author's information, her records.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So anyway, the scene continues and he gets booed and jeered at. And he declares that she has only paid 78% of her taxes. And so he says that she was stealing from the government, as if the government has earned this money and is owed this money because of the wonderful services that you have duly purchased the government to have to do. And I love her responses for the most part. At first she says, I only stole from the government if I recognize your right to audit me, which is a beautiful statement. I think everybody should make. I think far too many people just assume that these people have a right to come in and demand money from you for anything. We don't allow private businesses to just come up and demand our money for a service we may or may not want. But for some reason, we allow government to just come up. Now, her reasoning for doing it, for only paying 78%, is, I do applaud it for the most part.
It's like a half credit.
I would prefer that she, didn't pay any of it because you're completely illegitimate. But her stance is that there's some things that she wants the government to do, other things she doesn't want the government to do. So she's a minarchist in that sense. That she's okay with, fixing potholes and putting up swing sets and things like that. But she says that she doesn't want it spent towards national defense, corporate bailouts, and campaign discretionary funds. And he says that that is anarchy. Now, in that sense, I'm somewhat agree with him, because anarchy is deciding what you want to pay for, right? Now, it's not paying money to a government to go do a whole bunch of crap, but it is, in the sense, the market way of, hey, I'm going to hire you to do this very specific thing and only this one specific thing, and not to do all these other things with this money. So in that sense, he's kind of right. Now, I think they get the whole idea. Yeah, inadvertently right. I mean, he's saying it in one way and I'm explaining it in a way that, yeah, they don't understand. But then he asks her if she's an anarchist. And, then they get into this little thing about them assembling. And she says, wouldn't that defeat the purpose of anarchy if anarchists assembled into groups
and had meetings?
And that is completely wrong. Of course, anarchists can get together. They can have meetings. They can take notes. They can get into groups. They can hang out.
They can talk about movies.
We can talk about movies and still be principled anarchists. All it means is that we don't have rulers, movie writer. But I do appreciate that they tried to kind of a little bit. This is almost one of the more fair representations that I've seen in a movie, in a mainstream Hollywood movie. It kind of blew me away at how accurate it was, even though it wasn't super accurate. It was damn close. But so it was a lot of fun. Later on, he shows up at the bakery again, and she goes, oh, you're here early. You must have a lot of people to extort, later on. So that I really appreciated. It's really kind of digging in that he's there threatening her with, violent force, and that this is, somebody who is a violent thug, not to be trusted and not to be played nice with. And the fact that she ends up falling for him and they fall in love and whatever kind of betrays all that. But I do appreciate that those lines are in the movie, and those scenes are in the movie, and that he's treated as such. Because usually if you see an IRS agent in a movie, it's not given this level of depth as to why we don't like the IRS or government in general. So yeah, now, that's fun stuff.
Is it just me, or did you find it almost shocking how they treated him when he walked in? Because to me, I've never considered that being a way to treat someone, even if they are there extorting you, because they have this cover of legitimacy and it's been indoctrinated into us and all of that. So that was actually pretty shocking to me. But, and Rachel, I'll direct this to you. Have you ever seen people respond in this way to, I mean,
not
I'm sure
to their face. Yeah. Not to their face. They may call them every name in the book but when they get the letter or whatever, but they're not. I think that's as a tax provider, as a tax professional, I would not recommend treating someone who's going to assess you additional fines and penalties in that manner. I mean, it's kind of like you get more flies with honey than vinegar. So that's, I mean, some people do. So I had a tax attorney friend and he gave them no quarter, no respect whatsoever. But golly, I mean, they've got the power of the state behind them and she's just a little baker. So I wouldn't do it. I don't talk to them like that and call me a wuss if you want, but I feel like I get better outcomes by not being a jerk, even though you want to do that but they hold your fate in their hands.
Yeah. It's an asymmetrical amount of power being wielded on either side. Right.
Right. And it is a little unbelievable that she would fall for this guy who has the potential to cost her a lot of money. I mean, there's nothing less sexy than an IRS agent. I mean, that would kill any
Thank
sort of
you.
Emotions.
Yeah. Well, I guess we can get into this now. So Robert, what kind of questions did you have? And before you mentioned that, I just want to throw out there that I felt like his approaching her with just, I want you. It was almost, we'd almost done the crudes with you, Rachel. That was like a caveman come on to her. And I can't imagine that would be successful.
But it was a little bit like, it was in truth to his character, right? He was being true to character. Like he was he's a nerd. He's a very direct, like on the spectrum guy that has to deal with these beings called human beings. And he's just trying to kind of figure out how to do that. And I find that kind of directness refreshing, because usually there's a big song and dance and you're playing this game and you're not sure what's going on and you're doing a whole lot of guessing, and that can be fun too, but there's a certain amount of, I don't know, relief that you get when you know where you stand with somebody. And that I can think could be attractive. I don't know from her perspective, we don't get a whole lot of information about her character, especially leading up to their interaction. So we don't know where she's at in her romantic life. We don't know if she just got out of a breakup or what if she's on the hunt or, you know, looking or what, or just had her heart broken or we don't know. All we know is that somehow, for some reason, this smoking hot, gorgeous woman who works in this bakery just happens to be single and for some reason falls for Will Ferrell, the tax IRS man who is extorting money out of her.
Right. So socially awkward.
She obviously doesn't have very good judgment.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Will Ferrell isn't catch. I don't know. I don't know if he's handsome or he's probably in real life. He's probably very funny and whatever and charming. But in this movie, I don't buy the romance because I don't get the appeal from her perspective.
Right. And I do retract his caveman thing would be unsuccessful because it does display an earnestness, which might be something that puts him over the top with her somehow. You know,
she probably has some sympathy, right? She has some sympathy towards him because she realizes he's, you know, this wasn't his idea, but it is his job, even though she shouldn't give him a pass because it's his job. And that she gave him that big giant box of stuff.
Flowers.
Her receipts. To look through. She felt bad about that. She's like, no, this is a fuck you. If you're going to have to do this, you're going to suffer while you do this. Which take every chance you can to make their life worse. They shouldn't feel good about what they do. So.
Right. And it's a Fourth Amendment violation. And it certainly, in my estimation of reading the Fourth Amendment, it certainly seems like one. But I guess the other thing with the romance angle at that time when he was doing the caveman thing, he also had brought her a box of flour or a box of flowers, right? Different varieties. So I guess that's clever and cute. And because it was baking flowers and she's a baker, it like meant that he was really thinking, you know, about her and whatever. So, you know, that's another thing, like a tick box in his favor with her earning, winning her over, winning her favor.
Yeah, but did you buy that they had any real chemistry at any point in time? Like, I get that he could be kind of like charming in like a sad puppy kind of a way. Like, here's this guy that's trying to be, you know, he's earnest. He doesn't really get human interaction very well. But did you buy that they, you know, that she would find this man attractive and that they had any kind of real romantic chemistry?
You know, I think it was, it's very similar in a lot of ways to what we did last week with Raylene, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I mean, the Joel character and the Clementine character, maybe they're not as extreme as those characters, but they're in the same kind of general directions, right? Like, Maggie is more of a free spirit in this one, and Will Ferrell, what's his character's name?
Will Ferrell is as tight-laced as it gets.
Harold Crick.
Yeah. And, you know, it's almost like how Jim Carrey played Joel Barish and how Clementine played, or what's her bucket, played Clementine. Like, these movies to me seem very similar, and so I thought it was interesting that we did them back-to-back through no fault of our own. It just kind of happened that way.
Oh, but for sure.
It does feel like there's a bit of a theme going related to these movies and just how they're created, how they're told, how they're written. It has that Kaufman-esque kind of feel to it. So does the Walter Mitty movie. Like, that kind of quirky, weird takes on things. But yeah. I digress.
I don't know. I have a problem with romance in movies in general. I grew up on the Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan romance movies and the, you know, When Harry Met Sally kind of stuff. And those movies were solely focused, almost entirely focused on the romance. And I understand you got a concept and you want to do other things and you just chuck a romance in there. But for me, the romance has to feel genuine to me. Like I really could picture someone falling for somebody who is like this. You know what I mean? Like I fell for Meg Ryan watching those movies. Like, oh yeah, I could see why Tom Hanks would want her. And then on the flip side, I could be like, well, he's really charming and, you know, they're about equally attractive or whatever. And I could see how she would fall for him. Like, they give these lines, they write the characters in such a way that they are endearing, funny, charming. And I could see why they would fall for it. And then they actually have interactions that, you know, endear them to each other in the movie. And this movie has some of that. Don't get me wrong. It does have some, they do some things that endear each other to them, but man, I just don't think the movie gave me enough to really fall for it. Especially not the way in which at the end when she's like coming to his bedside and like, I mean, I get it, you know, she has feelings for him and he's sick and almost dead or whatever, but I just wish the romance was just a little more fleshed out. That's all.
Okay. I know
some of that hit the cutting room floor.
Yeah. You can tell they made an effort because they had that one cookie scene where she made cookies for him and had him try them. And then he like pulled the bonehead move of, well, I can't accept a gift. I have to pay for them.
Yeah. That was pretty good. That's actually a really nice little scene. That felt genuine. That felt like two characters connecting on another level. That was nice. And then if that movie had more scenes like that, I probably would have bought the romance a little bit more.
Okay. So Rachel, what's your take on Robert's perception of this romance from a, you know, a womanly perspective? Do you see how a Will Ferrell character in this can kind of win over a Maggie in this?
As a tax auditor, no. I mean, maybe. I mean, maybe they just didn't have time. Maybe they had more scenes where their relationship went a little, or, you know, they more flirtatious scenes than what ended up in the final cut of the movie. Maybe some of that hit the cutting room floor. And so we're not seeing the full progression. But I do have a hard time believing that somebody would fall for the guy that's auditing them. But I mean, at least it was not like in a creepy way, like he was going to, you know, because you could have like a quid quid pro quo type thing where it's like, oh, well, if you sleep with me, then I'll make this tax debt go away. And that, there's probably some of that that goes on, but it, at least that didn't happen in the movie.
Well, there was the allusion to it potentially. I mean, not that that was the purpose of it, but when he said, hey, I don't want you to end up in jail. So, you know, you, all those scones you donate, you can write those off and that'll probably square you on, like I squared my bet with Robert on the Seahawks losing in the first round of the Rams.
Got lucky, lucky.
But I'm sure a third party, you know, like viewing that exchange of information could perceive that as quid pro quo.
Yeah,
it's possible.
And it also, I'm sure, to a Robert point, would show the arbitrariness of the amount of money that they claim you owe. You know, if he can just come up with something like that and say, well, you don't actually owe it because of, you know, this reason over here that I just made up.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen the end, the conclusion of that plot point, because they kind of just ignore it, right? It's just kind of over. They don't come through and say, okay, now we're falling in love, but yeah, you owe the government like $38,000 or whatever. They don't do that part. And that would have been a fun scene, probably.
Probably would have been the end of that relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't really seem like one that would fudge numbers. He seemed like a pretty straight shooter.
Yeah. He seems incapable of, lying or submitting false reports or whatever.
So, Rachel, do you have any other point you wanted to make related to the relationship, or because I have a question I kind of want to point to Robert regarding story and structure?
No, I think that's it. I kind of agree with Robert that the relationship felt forced, but it's kind of like, well, we got to get through this movie and we got to show that his life doesn't suck anymore. And suddenly he's got a reason to live, because if he was living like a COVID lifestyle before the COVID lifestyle was cool. You know, he didn't go out with friends. He didn't, he lived a life devoid of much pleasure at all. And so they've got to have this relationship so that it makes, because if he was going to die when he was still Harold Crick at the first of the movie, he would have been like, all right, I don't really have much to live for. But now he's learned to play the guitar. He's got a beautiful girl. Now he's got something to live for. And he didn't before.
Right. Right. And Tony Hale's his buddy now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that's funny. When I was watching this, I too thought about the COVID quarantine kind of situation, because he was kind of living that lifestyle. Before it was cool, 14 years ago, 15 years ago, whenever this was made, before it became a thing. But
yeah, Karen Eiffel kind of was too. The author.
Oh, big time. She was.
Yeah, she's
right.
Like,
they didn't
the one who had mental, diagnosable issues.
Yeah. I liked when they were at the hospital and Queen Latifah, she was talking about, oh, he's just here to see the sick people. And Queen Latifah's like oddly spoken with disdain, because that's why she was there too.
Right. Right. And then she talks to one of the nurses and is like, yeah, we're the ones that aren't going to make it. Like this almost sick kind of way of approaching it. But she's detached from it. She is almost as socially stunted as Harold Crick in a way,
mm-hmm.
slightly different sure. way, but she doesn't know how to interact with other human beings.
Right. No, she it probably allows her to write him very accurately.
Right. Now that ties into my story question. At the end, when Dustin Hoffman says it's the perfect book, but then she changes it and he says, now it's just kind of okay. And I get what he's going for. Like there is a symmetry to the story ending with him sacrificing himself to save that boy. But then she has that crisis of conscience and can't bring herself to do it. And then she says that she'll rewrite the preceding portions of the book to make the ending make more sense. And so my question to you, Robert, is, do you think that the movie is that revised version of the story? So she changed her story to bring in this whole weird thing that happened to her and him to bring in the whole she's somehow narrating his life and he becomes aware of it. And so the end product of the novel is, in fact, the story that we are seeing in the movie.
I did not get that. It's possible. I saw it more of the novel was some version of what we were seeing. I saw the irony and the reason why her version of the novel ended so well and was so poetic or whatever was because he was killed by his own watch, because he lived his life by his watch and he lived his life by numbers. And finally his watch betrays him and he was actually there early, and otherwise he wouldn't have been there to throw himself in front of the bus. Not necessarily because he saved some kid or not, because otherwise, I mean, why would saving a kid or not saving a kid have any impact on or have any poetic meaning to his life? I mean, his life doesn't revolve around kids in any way, or even this particular kid. So there's no real great tragedy in that. It would just be in the sense of the being finally betrayed by the numbers that he loved so much. And even in that, we don't get enough of her novel to really be able to judge it. Of course, they say it's great and whatever, but it doesn't strike me as this fantastic story, this IRS agent that is ruled by numbers and whatever, and then kind of falls in love and then dies by numbers. On paper, it sounds pretty stale, maybe a little even boring, but of course, you can tell a simple story in an interesting way and make it amazing. I think the movie was as good as it could have been with the premise that we were given.
Right. Okay.
There were some great comedic moments with him hearing this voice. And then of course the whole interaction with the Hoffman character, who was just fantastic. And I think really cements and elevates this film. Without the Hoffman character, it is a much more dull movie. Although I think the writer character lady was also excellent.
Yeah, she's great.
The Queen Latifah character, I didn't really get a whole lot out of. I'm not even really a whole lot clear on why she was there, other than to give the writer lady somebody to talk to and somebody to make fun of.
Right, for the exposition of it.
Right. She's basically there to provide a time crunch. Like, hey, the publishers want this done finally, and you've been sitting on this for a long time and whatever.
Right. Now that actually plays into a related question to my comment on the story and the fantasticality of it, of this whole like concept of she's created a character and it turns out that he's real somehow. She'd been working on this book for 10 to 12 years, right? That's what they talk about.
Yeah, she's been in that one interview she gives, yeah.
Right. And he's been a tax accountant for 12 years. So I'm wondering if in the fantasticality of this, she manifested him 12 years prior as a fully formed adult IRS agent who was just on this routine of numbers and whatever. Like if in the fantasy of this, he did not exist any time prior to being a fully grown adult IRS agent in this routine, and it took her 12 years to finally figure out how she was going to write this story and kill him, right? That's the whole Queen Latifah with the time crunch. And that's when whatever magic happened, where he can then become aware of her narration. And that's what spins off all of these events.
Yeah, I could buy that if the movie gave us a better answer as to why all of a sudden he's hearing her voice. Like if he had been hearing her voice his entire life, he had no memories of his childhood. Like when Dustin Hoffman's interviewing him and he's like, well, talk to me about your childhood. And he's like, I have no memories of that, blah, blah, blah. I only have memories of when I started working for the IRS. Then that would be kind of fun. And then he's always been hearing her his whole life, but it was just normal to him. And then something happened at the start of this movie that made him think, what? This isn't normal. You're not all hearing voices. And then maybe that kind of played in. Then I would think that'd make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. There's no catalyzing mechanism to kick this off. Right. Like all of a sudden he can hear her when he's brushing her, brushing his
just
teeth.
Just randomly. Why?
Yeah.
Because it's the start of the movie. I know the answer, but there's no real narrative reason why.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So Rachel, what do you think? The story structure, do you think that it makes sense that he might have been manifested by her starting the novel and then she changed the novel itself to like support the new ending? My little fan fiction theory here.
Honestly, I had not thought about it that deeply. I just watched the movie and enjoyed the movie. But I mean, it does, like, because her narration drives him to do things that then she can later narrate. So, you know, like he screamed at this guy. Well, he was screaming at this guy because she kept talking. Mm-hmm. So it,
but she didn't seem to be aware of him doing that.
Right. Right. Yeah. And maybe, you know, as far as like, you know, why wasn't he hearing the voice before, you know, when the phone was ringing and she'd already written, she was typing it. When she typed, then the phone rings. She typed another line, the phone rang. And she'd already written the end of the story, but she hadn't typed it. So I guess her typewriter is magical. Isn't there a John Candy movie where he has a magical typewriter?
Who's Harry Crumb?
Like Delirious, or I don't know. It's like he was a writer for soap operas or something. That just popped in my head all of a sudden. Mm. But you know, it's like the typewriter here in this is the magical device that makes things happen in Harold Crick's life.
Yeah, they did. That did come across that he only heard the typed narration, not the written narration. So yeah, maybe if she hadn't really worked on the story at all for the past 10, 12 years, and then now she's starting it back up again, so that's why he hears it. But it still doesn't explain whether or not he is a completely imaginary, invented character. And, you know, she had only ever written the story on paper and pencil, and then just now she's all typing it all up. But I don't know. I think it's just kind of fun to ignore all that, just let that go and just kind of enjoy it and just take it in, let it wash over you. Just don't think about it too much and just kind of have fun.
That sounds very un-Robert like. Who are you and what have you done with the Robert we've come to know and love and despise for ruining Star Wars?
Yeah. But it deserved it. I don't do it to things that only do it to those that deserve it. Now for this, I think it's such a fun premise. And it's such a ridiculous premise that you can't take it too seriously. There is some magic involved. You're not exactly sure where or how or why or what. And so you just kind of, it's not really explained. So you just kind of go along for the ride. If it had tried too hard to explain it, you'd go, oh, come on, bullshit. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't fit with this or that plot point or why this character says that or does that. So you're more forgiving, or at least I'm more forgiving for it. Like, it's like when there's hard magic systems versus soft magic systems. I don't know if anybody's familiar with this, but in like the Lord of the Rings, it's a soft magic system because it's this mysterious thing that Gandalf can just kind of do here and there. And you're not sure how he does it or how he's able to do it or what he can do or what he can't do. But it's just this kind of amazing thing that only some people can do. Whereas if it's a hard magic system, there are like legitimate established rules that only X, Y, and Z can happen and only under these situations and done by these people in this certain specific way. But that really limits you as to what magic can be, but it makes sense, more sense to the viewer. Whereas in a soft magic system, and like in Lord of the Rings, you're just kind of like, oh, okay, magic.
Yeah, let that wash over you.
Yeah, and just let it wash over. You don't really question it too much. Like, nobody's really breaking down like Gandalf and like saying, that's fucking bullshit, Gandalf. You can't do that. But you just kind of watch it and you're just kind of like, oh, the wonder of magic and blah, 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 blah. So I think in this movie, you just kind of let it wash over you and you're just kind of along for the fun ride.
Unlike when Wonder Woman can fly.
Yeah, that's fucking bullshit.
Or that an island.
Fucking lightning bolt. Get out of here.
Or that an island full of women would all get along.
Exactly. That's the most unrealistic thing in the whole movie.
Yeah. Or that they think they can get an Oscar.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Did you hear that, Rachel?
I did not hear that.
There's a big push for Wonder Woman 84 to get an Oscar for Best Picture.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
Oh, yeah.
That's 2.5 hours of my life I'll never get back.
You know,
Unlike Stranger Than Fiction, I've watched this over and over again. I will never again watch Wonder Woman 84.
Now, would Wonder Woman 84 qualify for this upcoming Oscars, or would it qualify for the following year's Oscars? Because, you know, if it's like the only movie running, by default, it is Best Picture.
You got no other movies. Yeah, because wasn't there a, when Netflix won something, like there was a big anti-Netflix push in Hollywood to be like, no, these movies don't count. They're not real movies. Only movies that make it to a actual theater and are released by these people and blah, 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 blah. So I think probably with the big push to go to streaming services, that'll go away. But yeah, I remember that. That was dumb, but you know, classic protectionist move.
Well, they're being inconsistent again. What a shock.
It's okay when we do it, but not when these other people do it.
How consistent of them to be inconsistent.
Yes,
consistently inconsistent. We expect nothing else from them.
All right. So
speaking of consistently inconsistent, I thought since we're talking about an IRS auditor and as the subject of our movie here, I thought I would share a little good news. Y'all have probably seen the news that the IRS is planning on upping their audits of small businesses.
What they're going to up them up remain. Yes.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the ones that are left. No, they'll still audit ones that are out of business and still try to collect money from them. So that they're equal opportunity auditors, but they're supposed to up them by like 50%. But I know that sounds like a huge number, but they really don't audit that many. The audit risk is pretty low and has been for quite, you know. Do you all remember the thing where the IRS had shot these educational videos where they were dressed up like Star Trek, and then they found out that they had done like these. Yeah, like a few years ago, they got a lot of their funding cut. I guess it's probably been 7 or 8 years ago. I don't remember off the top of my head, where they lost a lot of their funding because they were taking their budget and using it to create these training videos where they were like Star Trek themed.
Oh, wow.
Which makes it kind of funny that that guy wants to go to space camp in the movie Stranger Than Fiction, but they were just spending gobs of money on these Star Trek themed training videos. And so Congress came in and kind of smacked them around and cut their budget way down. And that's been, I can't remember if that was when, I guess it was still when Obama was still in office. And wow, so audits have been way down because the IRS's budget was cut. And now they're bumping it up. But like in 2018, they only audited 140 partnership returns out of all 4 million that were filed. So even if they up the audits by 50%, that's only 210 partnership returns out of 4 million. So it's still going to be a pretty small amount. So I know people think, oh, they're upping it by 50% and think that's a huge amount that they're going to go up, but the audit risk is still pretty dang low right now.
That's an example.
And they only hired
lie with statistics.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And they only hired like 50 more specialized auditors to work on these audits. So we're not talking about a huge caseload increase. I can't imagine.
Right. The only thing I remember recently related to the IRS under Obama was that they were used to unfairly target conservative groups to audit them as like political punishment or something ridiculous.
Yeah. I looked it up real quick and it was, they spent $60,000 on Star Trek themed on one Star Trek themed training video. And this was like in 2010 that this happened. And then Congress came in and smacked them with a budget cut.
See, I bet they could deduct everything for that, the lights and the cameras and all the stuff, right?
Well, they don't have to pay tax because they're the government.
Right, right. And even yeah, that's the other thing. Like, this is an argument that I hear often is any government employee doesn't actually effectively pay any tax because their salary is all from tax proceeds. So the fact that they have to give some of it back doesn't mean they've paid any tax. They just got less than they otherwise would. And then one final thing related to the tax question. I remember in a Rothbard lecture, he talked about how Reagan's really great with his rhetoric and he's, you know, pro freedom and rah, 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 and speaks ill of taxation and how it actually harms people and harms business. But then he increased their budget. So one side of his mouth is like, oh, taxation is detrimental or too much is harmful, whatever. But on the other side, he's actively giving them more resources to be more effective at it.
Well, it's just a matter of time before their budget gets pumped back up. I mean, of course, I guess if we could just, the Federal Reserve can just print money, it doesn't really matter. You know, one of the points that Jeff Dice made in the Monopoly on Violence is that if they can just print money for some of it, if they can fund the government with debt, some of it with debt, then why can't they fund 100% of it with debt? Why are they even fleecing us?
It's a method of control and influence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't also, though, the ability for the government to borrow based on the goodwill of the people to eventually repay it, right?
Yeah, my great-great-grandchildren.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, we should probably start to wind this one down. Any final notes either one of you wishes to make before we get into that final summary and review?
I did want to say one thing, which it, you know, in the scene where Dustin Hoffman says, you could just, your life is, you're probably going to die pretty soon. And he's just so matter of fact about it. And he's like, and because of that, you could just go eat pancakes until you die. And Will Ferrell was just outraged. He's like, well, this is my life. And he says, why would I eat pancakes instead of live my life? And Dustin Hoffman made the point that it really depended on the quality of the pancakes versus the quality of the life being lived.
Right.
And
yeah, there's a whole lot of, oh, go ahead.
Having had my mother-in-law's buttermilk pancakes, I would have to agree with Dustin Hoffman on that point. Sometimes if it's a really good buttermilk pancake, that might be better than the life that Harold Quick was living at the first of the movie.
And that reminds me of a conversation I had just recently of, you know, all the COVID lockdowns, especially among the elderly, where it's almost as if the quality of life has been completely forgotten. And the quantity of life is the end all be all. And it's almost like you're evil if you want to have some kind of quality of life at any point in time, even if you're almost about to die. Like it's all about preserving life at all costs, no matter what, which is absolutely ridiculous.
And then they ultimately don't end up preserving any life anyway, because COVID still made its way into the nursing homes. So all they did was they ruined the lives. They ruined the lives of people. They shut them out of the lives of family members with dementia or terminal illnesses. And they ended up not getting quality or quantity.
Right, indeed. And that doesn't even account for the deaths of despair as a result of the lockdowns and restrictions and the loss of savings and businesses and hope and aspirations and dreams for everyone. It's pretty ridiculous. And then related to the movie, there's another part near the end where Dustin Hoffman is philosophizing a little bit on the finality of life or the ending of life when Harold Crick is like, hey, it's a big deal to me. I'm going to die here. And Dustin Hoffman says, well, you know, you could get hit by a bus or you could get cancer or a heart attack or drop dead, you know, in the street or whatever. You know, anything could take you out. But this way of going out, which ends this book so perfectly, will live on, you know, for generations. And so this art, this piece of art that you can help make by following through with this and accepting this fate is actually going to be better off for the world. And I thought that was kind of an interesting argument. And of course, all those other ways of dying that he mentioned would now be listed as COVID deaths, of course. But I did think that Dustin Hoffman was making a good point. Like, you can go out. You never know when you're going to go out or what's going to take you out. But you have this opportunity here in this magical, you know, universe they've built to fulfill this story and make this story an amazing piece of art.
Indeed. All the more reason for quality of life over quantity of life.
Well, I guess I kind of took the opposite of that away when he was giving Will Ferrell that speech. And I was like, who are you to decide? This is after the pancakes. And I thought the pancakes were funny because I love pancakes and my mother-in-law makes the best pancakes in the world. But when it's almost like the people that have told other people, stay at home, save lives. And it's very easy for them to say that because they're not the ones facing death. And we don't know what kind of life Hilbert had. You know, how fulfilling was his life? But he just said, oh, well, you know, you need to die for this book, or you need to die for the elderly. You know, he got to say this from this very elitist perspective. It's like, well, you know, this is worth it. But he's not the one that ought to get to decide that. Will Ferrell is the one that should make that decision, not Hilbert.
But he doesn't have any skin in the game.
Yeah, he did.
Ultimately, yeah, when he read the whole thing on the book or on the bus, and he's like, you know what? He's right.
Indeed. And ultimately, it was his decision, right?
I mean,
he, so.
Yeah, fortunately, Hilbert didn't have the power of the government behind him, so.
Yeah.
Harold really got to choose.
Indeed.
Well, that's what we're all for, is choosing, consent, voluntarist.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you volunteer your final summary and review and a score, a number of phone rings in the story, Robert?
Phone rings? What? What is this? I don't even remember. Was it
phone rings?
Was phone rings?
The phone rang.
What?
She typed out the phone rang, and it rang in real life. And then long pause. She typed it again.
Phone rang. At the end. Yeah. Okay.
That was the reveal where she realized it clicked for her. That she was writing the story and influencing events out in the world.
That's your key takeaway from this movie, is the phone ringing, huh? I mean, it's a key moment where she realizes the power of her typewriter.
All right, you want to give it a number of cookies?
Cookies or buses? I mean, I don't know, the buses.
Let's go with the cookies. Or audits? Audits?
Audits. All right, we'll go with... No, we'll go with cookies. I like cookies. That's a good idea.
All right.
Okay.
Out of 10 cookies.
Okay. Stranger Than Fiction, starring Will Ferrell. You know, I'm a huge fan, like I said, of romantic comedies, or at least back in the good old days of romantic comedies. I haven't seen a real proper romantic comedy in a long time, I don't think, off the top of my head. I don't know if they're really made like they used to be. I don't know if just Hollywood's changed or society's changed or what, but we don't see them that much. We did see Three Idiots, but that was a Bollywood movie, but that was pretty much a romantic comedy for the most part. Not so much focused on the romance though. It's Three Idiots is a lot like this movie, in that the romance is kind of truncated, kind of taken for granted. You're given a little bit, but you're left to really fill in a lot of the blanks that would really make the romance believable. But you know, this movie doesn't really rely. I think it's a big part. The romance is definitely a big part of this film, whether or not it works for you, but it's not everything. I think you can not buy the romance and still enjoy the heck out of this thing just for the premise and the execution of the comedy. I think Will Ferrell, if you don't buy Will Ferrell as the main character, then probably the movie falls apart. But this movie is an ensemble cast where a lot of different parts are coming together in a really fun way. And a lot of talented character actors. Holy smokes. The lady that plays the writer character does a great job. Dustin Hoffman is the standout for me. He was just so... Every minute he's on screen is a minute that I was glued to the screen. Like, he was so... Like, you knew his character. Like, he only had to say a few lines, and I was on board with who this guy was, what his attitude was. He's like one of those magical actors that just understands character and it just flows out of him. I can't really explain it other than to say that he's just some kind of wizard, because I knew who he was almost instantly, and I was on board and I liked him.
He's
so
got that soft magic, Robert.
He's got that soft magic, and then the screenwriter, he deserves a whole bunch of credit, and I'm sure the director and the editor all deserve a lot of credit, but you don't get that without Hoffman's masterful performance. So kudos to him. I'm sure, man, I should see him in more stuff. Maybe is he retired? I don't know, but man, he's a good guy. Anyway. Yeah, this is a lot of fun. It's not without its flaws, but for the way they treat the IRS agent and Dustin Hoffman and the concept, I can't give this a negative review. There's just no way. It's got to be a high positive. I'd say this is a strong seven cookies out of 10 cookies. Yeah, just for that alone. I can't find too many faults in it. other than to, you know, nitpick things that, you know, you don't make sense or whatever. You can, you could nitpick it, right? You could say, hey, how come Dustin Hoffman and the writer lady never have that moment where they're like, can you fucking believe this shit? This is real. This is really happening. Wouldn't you think that would happen? Like, holy shit, you have a magic typewriter or something. Somebody you wrote actually exists and you could have killed him and you didn't and whatever. That scene never happens. They just kind of take it for granted that this is a possibility in this universe. And it kind of works.
At first.
Well, she freaked out, but Dustin Hoffman's character never has that conversation with her. Anyway, you'd think like Queen Latifah would freak out, or I don't know, like somebody commenting on this. Usually in Hollywood movies, when something crazy happens or whatever that doesn't make any sense, they hang a lantern on it, like they make a joke about it, and then they just move on. But in this movie, they don't really do that. Like you said, the main writer character lady kind of has this crisis moment where she freaks out, but nobody else really, other than Will Ferrell, thinks it's weird that this happens. But whatever. It didn't break my enjoyment of the film. It was a lot of fun, and seven strong cookies out of 10.
All right, very good.
Homemade, not store bought cookies. Like made by Maggie Gyllenhaal. It would sound fantastic.
Unless of course they're David's cookies. Those are the best store bought cookies that actually taste homemade.
I don't even know if I've ever had those. Do they sell those around here, Daniel? Do you know?
If it doesn't say gluten-free on it, I have no idea.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, if Texit comes to fruition, your wife and your girls can try it.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about that a fair amount in the pre-show bonus content available for our Patreon supporters. Go to lastnightrs.com/Patreon and hear us talk about secession and Texit and whatnot for about 45 minutes, something like that. But anyway, Rachel, let's go to you for your final summary review. And how many cookies do you give this one?
Well, I enjoy the film. Like I said, we watch it pretty frequently. We didn't buy it, but we watch it when it's on Netflix or when it's free. Maybe we've rented it before, but I don't remember. I love Dustin Hoffman's performance in this, and Emma Thompson. As I rewatched it the other night, I'm like, she's really good in this role. So it is odd to see Will Ferrell playing the straight man and everybody else kind of being the comedic characters. So it's a nice to see that juxtaposition between him being the solid guy and everybody else kind of being the funny ones. And there's some great one-liners. I love watching movies where there's great one-liners in it that I can say later in relation to other things. So I would say, considering we watch it regularly or not, you know, rewatch it from time to time, I would say I'm going to give this like an 8 out of 10. And I'm knocking 2 points off because Will Ferrell's a tax collector.
Aren't you glad you're not a golem? Yes, I am.
I always thought that I would want to go to work for the IRS, not because, and this was back in my more status days, but even then I still thought the IRS was the enemy, but it was mostly, you know, so that you could be behind enemy lines and then be able to go out and advise clients, okay, these are less areas, less prone to audit risk or whatever, just to kind of get a peek behind the curtain and know how to advise clients better going forward. But ultimately I decided I couldn't square that with my conscience to work for the IRS.
Yeah. Yeah. And your score reminds me of the Ron Swanson scene in Parks and Rec where he takes that girl's sandwich, takes a bite of it and says, now you know about taxation. You taxed him.
Oh, you know what? I should have given it a 7.8. That would have been very smart on my point because she paid 78% of her taxes. I should have given it 7.8 out of 10.
There you go. There you go. Doing the thing I would do.
I'm withholding my 22% in protest of funding wars, although I'd have to withhold a whole lot more accurately reflect the budget as it is.
Right. And that's just the budget we know about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the idea on the score. I will give it a 7.8. I think that this is a very fun movie. It is very reminiscent of the one we did last week. And maybe not as well executed, or maybe the premise doesn't have quite the structure where you're kind of brought into at the end of the story in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You're kind of brought in at the beginning, at the end of the story. And then it kind of meanders its way through to the resolution. And I like that kind of a structure. This one's a little bit more straightforward, but it still breaks a lot of those narrative kind of modes. And it breaks a lot of barriers as far as like who's able to be aware of what. I think that all of the actors are pretty good. Queen Latifah, yeah, I don't know how great she was or how great she is as an actress, but Dustin Hoffman was amazing. Emma Thompson was amazing. Will Ferrell and Maggie Gyllenhaal were pretty good. I would put them a tier below those other two as far as performances goes. But I did enjoy this movie quite a bit. I did enjoy the discussions of anarchy and the arguments against paying full boat for taxes for services that you don't want to support. I think that is it's like a half credit response because you're still sort of like giving them the moral ground on which to tax you at all. But overall, good movie, 7.8 cookies from me. So thank you for the great discussion, Rachel. And yeah. Highly recommend people check out the previous appearances you've been on with us. And maybe in the future, we will end up doing The Croods. I know that was the movie we were considering during this time. And I also suggest people check out your shows, Cannabis Heals Me and Just Add Liberty. Now, Robert, next week, I'm going to throw a curveball at you. We're still going to talk to our man from Down Under, Shaheen. He is our Batman guy. We were going to do Lego Batman. However,
yes, it's on the schedule. It's Lego Batman.
On the schedule is Lego Batman. Unless you look right now, you'll see I have put an or. And that or is for Mad Max.
Or Mad Max, the original 1979 classic, Melly Gibson.
That's right. That's right. Due to recent events, just the nature of the world right now and the fact that he's in Australia and that he's based in Australia. And I saw a meme recently that said that, you know, Mad Max was set in 2021. I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes me want to do that one. So if you're game, he's game. Are we game? Are Mad Max in it?
I would have to look and see if I have some sort of access to it. I know it's on Netflix, but I don't have access to Netflix right now. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm generally in favor of Mad Max. I mean, my favorite is Fury Road. That's an amazing film. Have we already talked about Fury Road? Maybe we already have. I don't know.
Ancient history ago, we did. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I will go along to get along. I won't be too obstinate here, so that'll be fine. Whatever you decide, sir.
Okay, Mad Max, it will be, and I will make it available for you with the money that I saved.
Oh!
The Seahawks lost.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so conflicted now. Well, at least it's going to a good cause.
It's going to the Get Mad Max for Robert to be able to watch it on the shared services fund.
My poor chickens. Poor chickens. I don't know if I'm. Are you rooting for the Rams now? I don't know. I think they're going to get killed by Green Bay, honestly. But we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to see Tom Brady go out.
What? You're rooting for Brady? You're rooting for the Antichrist? What are He's you doing?
Goat. He's the goat.
No, I want to get out of here.
I want to see him out of the system because everyone said he was that Belichick was a crutch for him.
And he was always
around him. I want to see him doing that. And right off into the sunset.
Wow. It's like rooting for Darth Vader. Okay. All right. You have your preferences. I have mine. I want to see him fail miserably and get embarrassed by somebody, but all right.
All right. Well, now that we've got that squared away, why don't you tell people how they can get more of our content or support us in any way whatsoever?
Oh, yeah. You can go to patreon.com for the time being while we still are up on there, and you can subscribe. You can get all kinds of pre-show and post-show bonus content. And, you know, more importantly, you can just interact with us, tell your friends and family about us. Startup accounts on these alternative services. Get those things to be more popular, and it'll be more likely for other people to join you there. The network effect is real. And there's a big reason to be on these monolithic social networks that
It's almost, you almost have to be on there, even though you don't want to be. But if there are more and more reasons to not be, I read an article today about by the New York, no, this is Seattle Times. Cause a lot of these, social networks, Parler and other, I think I forget the other one, maybe Gab, but they were both described as far right, you know, extremist, terrorist, hotbeds or whatever. And they're both being, they're both hosted. I think at least Parler was hosted on Amazon and it is now being moved over to another hosting service, but it's here in the Western Washington or in Western Washington, some Sammamish based company. And, yeah. So anyway, yeah, get on those places. They're not, you know, as you would know, they are not just Nazi terrorist hotbed propaganda. They're just people that have been disenfranchised, been kicked off of, you know, these left-wing sites. And so they want to go somewhere else. And then that they get demonized for going somewhere else. And the somewhere else they go. And it's really just the left being upset that they don't control everything. It's really what it is. It just smacks of petulant crybabiness that they're just going to demonize anything they don't have total control over. So don't be, I mean, obviously you're not going to be swayed by their arguments. You know that they're not, you know, far right extremist hotbeds. They're more free speech platforms that aren't going to go around censoring and data mining you. So that's pretty attractive. And I understand though, the network effect is real, but go over there, start your accounts. And I understand that the interfaces aren't quite as friendly. It'll take some getting used to, but eventually we can have a more competitive market in the social media field. So that would be a help to everybody. And if you help everybody, you help us. So thank you very much.
Cause we're part of everybody.
We are all one.
Borg-like.
You will join the Borg.
All right. Well, hey, that's our show, everyone. So do check out Rachel's shows as well. I also wanted to say smells like Liberty, but no, it's just Ad.
It may smell too. You never know.
And Cannabis Heals Me. And we'll be back next week with the great Shaheen from Australia talking about Mad Max. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and we'll continue for just a few more minutes before we end this one and maybe do a little bit of Kathleen Turner Overdrive, though it is already late, and it is a random Tuesday night in January here. But Robert, you brought up a pretty interesting point, and this isn't really related to the movie per se, but the whole idea of going to alternative platforms and whatnot. And I got to admit, I'm in the midst of transitioning a couple of my accounts to different things, and I'm interested in opening some new accounts elsewhere as well. And I also have seen the demonization of these other accounts for merely being pro-free speech and not being willing to censor what can be said or discussed, because that's always a sign of that you're afraid of what people are going to say, because, you know, what's the worst they can do is persuade you to think something else. I mean, unless they're directly inciting violence or, you know, trying to actually commit a crime. But they've played all these word games recently where they've sort of restructured how the meaning of the word insurrection or inciting of violence actually is anymore, to where it's been stretched so far that it almost is meaningless. And you can almost clarify anyone as being guilty of these things, as it seems that they're trying to do by classifying nearly 75 million Americans as potential domestic terrorists simply for voting for Donald Trump. That being said, there is this problem of all of these different platforms being different, like that there's so many different options and none of them are that great just yet. But when everyone goes scurrying off into these separate corners, you sort of do sever a lot of those connections. And it seems like it's kind of difficult at this point to know where people are going to congregate, or at least people in your circle are going to congregate. And that's one of the problems with the network effect of Facebook, is that you have that familiarity and that network of people who you're used to are all there, Whereas now some people are going over to Gab, some are going to Parler, some are going over here, some are going over there, some are doing Telegram, some are doing Signal. And even those places are getting attacked and shut down and all of these things. So it does seem like we're in a very odd transitional phase, though I feel like I'm monologuing here, but I have high interest in shutting down my Twitter, shutting down Facebook, shutting down Patreon, shutting everything down and going to alternatives all across the board. It's just a matter of what alternatives are going to be viable, which ones are going to achieve network effect status, and which ones are going to be immune from the backlash by big tech and the left outrage mobs. And final point, where the hell is the ACLU? When we were kids, when we were left-leaning, when we were all for, you know, keeping the government out of the bedroom and the moralizing of the conservatives, the ACLU was defending Nazis, neo-Nazis, for their right to say what they wanted to say. And whose quote was it? I don't agree with what you say, but I will fight to the death for your right to say it. What happened to that? Take it away, Robert.
It died.
Yeah, that died. It was shot, buried in a unmarked grave, just like a little bit of dirt sketched over it. The principled left is long gone. And the old guard of the left, that would be somewhat principled or mostly principled, they're dying off, man. And it is more about power and control and using whatever tool to bludgeon you with that works at the moment, not even if it completely contradicts what they used to bludgeon you with yesterday. So what you said about the network effect is real. Absolutely. But I don't really know this to be true or not, but I suspect that it'll be a bit like, you know, dipping your toe into a very cold water. First it seems painful, unfamiliar, unsure of what's going to happen. But then once you actually get in, then it'll soon to become and feel more normal. So I think you'll miss out on the features and the people on Facebook and Twitter and whatever. But as you know, it's like moving to a new town when you were a kid. You didn't want to leave your old friends, but your parents said, you know what, you'll make new friends. And, you know, your parents were right. It's a shame, but it's, I don't see, you know, when the vast majority of the left are not interested in actual intellectual, honest discourse, they are just interested in bashing you over the head and calling you the worst names in the book, and you have to conform to X, Y, and Z. Oh, and by the way, it'll be A, B, and C tomorrow, but you know, and we're going to change everything and change the rules, and we're only going to apply the rules to the people we agree to, the people we don't agree with, not to the people we agree with. We'll let them get away with murder. We don't give a fuck. You know, it's just going to encourage people to leave. So we can be, you know, the trailblazers. We can get over there and we can set up shop, and when our friends come over, we can welcome them home.
Well, the problem is they're not even content with us leaving. It's like everybody that tells us we'll move to Somalia. If you don't like the U.S., move to Somalia. And so we all move to Somalia, and then they drop a nuclear bomb on Somalia. So they're not even content with us leaving and going off to our own little corners. They still want to control us.
They still want to dominate and control. They'll be like, look at all these neo-Nazis that go to the parlor. Let's shut them down because... Mm-hmm. Reasons, but that's I've heard Gab hosts their own stuff. They have their own payment processor. They're completely independent, and they basically cannot be shut down, other than, you know, the government turning off their electricity or something.
I wouldn't put it past them.
Yeah, me neither.
That's why Thomas Massey's off the grid.
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
He's a fairly likable guy when it comes to politicians. He's up there. It's a low bar.
Yeah, it's very low. It's almost as low as being a good guy for a tax collector. Low.
Oh yeah.
His home is totally off the grid. He's in this documentary or something, and they're talking about his home. And he said, the reason I'm off the grid is because the first thing the government does to you when you're not doing what they want you to do is they turn your power off.
Oh yeah, we saw that.
It's kind of hard to
Los Angeles with mm-hmm. people. Or not following restrictive guidelines or having parties or whatever. They shut their power off.
That's right. Right. We're going to shut your power and your water off. Well, if you can't blot out the sun yet, I mean, I think Bill Gates is trying to do that.
Yeah. I've heard that. Putting aluminum in the air or something to like reflect a lot of the energy, something like that.
Something, I don't know. And, you know, I was talking to some friends of mine because I had a guest on a couple weeks ago and we talked about vitamin D and how important it is and the role that it plays in keeping COVID from getting as bad, you know, having such a severe case of COVID. And then I was talking to some friends of mine and they're a little further out there as far as like, and I don't know, because it's like, you only have the capacity to dive down so many rabbit holes. So like, I've not dived down the 5G rabbit hole. They're like way down in the burrow, you know, down there with the rabbit hanging out. And then they've also done, you know, more of this Bill Gates stuff. So I was talking to them about vitamin D and they're like, oh, well, Bill Gates is trying to put the sun shield on and it would prevent the sun's rays from getting through. So, I mean, that if that's the case, then that prevents us from being able to get vitamin D. And anyway, so we had a little conversation about that. And yeah, I put my tinfoil hat on for a little bit, but then I took it back off later.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the occasional wearing is interesting, diving down a few mm-hmm. holes here and there. But yeah, if you take all the pills all at once, it's a bit much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I can only take one or two at a time and I still have to seem somewhat professional in my chosen profession. Can't be a total nutter.
Well, maybe don't direct people to listen to any episodes with us because that'll disqualify you. But anyway.
She's hanging out with those anarchists.
That's right. Talking about movies. Well, I think that's going to be our show tonight, everyone. So do check out Rachel's other shows at cannabisheelsme.com and Just Add Liberty. Is that justaddliberty.com?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very good. And we will have the show notes and more for this here episode at actualanarchy.com/216. You can support the show over at Patreon for now. And we're probably going to move over to some other format in the near future. And we're going to lose all the socials that we have. I got the 4-year Twitter anniversary notification the other day. And it's like this automated thing that they make with a little graphic. Like, you remember your Twitterversary? And then under that, I said, this will be our last. Find us somewhere else. Because, you know, if they don't kick us off, I will eventually leave. But they're going to kick us off pretty soon, I'm pretty sure. So anyway, that's our show. Everyone, peace out. We'll see you guys next week for Mad Max with the great Shaheen. And Rachel, we'd love to have you back in the near future, maybe Crudes or something else, whatever you're interested in. And with that, we'll say maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.